Okay. This microphone should be higher. What's the story here, my friend? All right. All set, Reg? Good, good, good. Let's do this thing. No waiting around. Let's just boom, boom. All right. Episode 414. Put it in the book. Ready on the trigger? All right. Here we go. Star, smile, strong. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. Where else would we be? As I've said many times here, listening is integral to this entire experience. But a close second is getting out there and telling your friends, telling your family, tell anybody who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Spread the word. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Of course, if you like what you hear, and hopefully you do because you're listening now, you can hear more of this. So much more. With just a couple of keystrokes, or swipes, or touches, however you are listening to this podcast, whatever mechanical or physical movements you use, the first thing is to go to WGNRadio.com, go to the podcast section, and then hit the prompt for this podcast, and then... Oh, Nirvana. Hundreds of podcasts just waiting, including this one that's just waiting for you. Number 414. So you can never predict the reaction to something, public reaction. You can guess. You can come close. It's not impossible. But many times you will be fooled. Sometimes it's exactly what you expect. An event, an announcement, it gets the exact response you would expect. For instance, what, last week or so, Taylor Swift releases a new album. The tortured artist department or the tortured poet department, whatever it is. You see how much it's on my radar screen, right? I think it's the tortured poet department. Makes this announcement. It's going to drop at midnight on a certain day, certain time. The Swifties out there waiting with bated breath. And then like 2 hours later, boom, another album gets released. Holy smokes. As you'd expect, as I said, the reaction was overwhelming. The Swifties came out in full force, downloading, viewing, liking, blowing up the internet. Whatever happens, it happened. You could have predicted that one, right? Especially at this point. You could predict that. A new Taylor Swift album coming out on the heels of this extremely successful billion-dollar tour that has been touring not only the United States, but now globally. The sale of her albums, old albums re-recorded and re-released. And then, of course, the headline-grabbing, gossip column-dominating football season enrapturing love affair between Taylor and Travis Kelce, who just happens to go on and win a Super Bowl while he starts dating her. I mean, what more can you ask for? And then on top of it, boom, not only one new album, but two new albums, 31 new songs for the starving and always anticipating legion of Swifties out there that hang upon her every lyric and every song. I mean, what more can you ask for, right? So that you couldn't expect. When this album was released, it got the reaction that you didn't need to be a psychic to predict that one. Then on the other hand, things happen and you would say, oh, well, that's going to be a big deal. And it doesn't. I remember as a young kid, and I'm dating myself here. Some people will remember this name. Some people may have heard it. Some people don't even know who I'm talking about. But there was an entertainer, a comedian named Bob Hope, who pretty much dominated the entertainment world for at least 50 years. And that's not an exaggeration. Between radio and television into the 90s, and I think he was 100 years old, but literally 50, if not 60 years, this guy was a major force. He was in films, he was in radio, and he was on television. Those, in his lifetime, those were the three main dominating entertainment delivery systems, which we call them now, the three main platforms, we call them now. They didn't call them that then. They were just TV, radio, and movies. But now we have a cool word for them. They're called platforms. But Bob Hope was dominant in each one of those. And he literally was one of the richest men in show business, and one of, and in his lifetime, not maybe toward the end, but certainly during his heydays of the 40s, 50s, 60s, and even 70s, his popularity began to wane then in the 80s and 90s. He was living more off of his reputation and his legend, and being an older comedian, he was given that respect. He wasn't really breaking any more rules or making people die of laughter or being all that entertaining. But he was a staple. He was familiar, and he had done enough that he gained or was given that status. But he had a career at least 50 years, if not longer. I mean, and it goes back to even the vaudeville days. So you can say he may have been in the entertainment industry for 70 years. And he was considered at one time the biggest star in the world. Now, you look at Bob Hope today, and some people will watch his films or listen to him or watch his TV specials, which were became for many years, for decades, were key television moments. There's a Bob Hope special on NBC. And as I said, as time went on, they became less and less important. But when they were in the 50s and 60s and 70s, when Bob Hope had a TV show, had a special on, people watched. Bob Hope was one of the few celebrities that was allowed to simply walk on The Tonight Show. You can go online and you could watch, different episodes of the Johnny Carson show now. And you can really appreciate how good Johnny was. But in the 60s and especially in the 70s, Bob, you know, as I said, was now this, this entertainment emeritus. You know, he had reached a certain status where he was the king of show business. And, you know, Johnny has a show, right? Johnny has a regular show. You know, he's got his guests lined up. He's got a schedule. And then all of a sudden, because Bob Hope's TV specials were on NBC, in the middle of the Johnny Carson show, while he's talking to somebody, all of a sudden, the curtain opens to the side and they play Bob's, the band plays Bob's theme song. Whether these were planned or not, I don't know. Whether Johnny was a really good actor and turned and looked surprised, but Bob would just, there was no introduction for Bob. Johnny would be talking to a guest. They would be into a good conversation or something in the middle of the show, and all of a sudden you'd hear, ba, 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 da, 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 da. Thanks for the memories. That was Bob Hope's theme song. And the curtain opens, and then Bob just strolls out, and all whatever was happening stops because Bob has arrived. And Bob just saunters over to the couch. He shakes Johnny's hand. He is expecting the seat next to Johnny to be open. Whoever was sitting there during their segment with Johnny had better gotten up and left that seat, because Bob is sitting in that seat next to Johnny, whether this was your time or not. That's the kind of clout that he have. I have heard stories later on that Johnny resented that. But at the same time, as I said, Bob Hope was this entity that you know, especially on NBC, where they both were, and even though Johnny was probably at that time equally as powerful, if not more powerful, than Bob Hope was as far as an entertainer, and certainly as a TV entertainer. But Bob Hope, as I said, had this 40 or 50 year legacy behind him. So he felt that he could just stop whatever's happening, because you're going to want to talk to Bob Hope. Bob Hope just doesn't show up anywhere. And that was kind of the attitude. And Johnny went with it. Whether his bosses told him to go with it because it was on the same network to promote the show, I'm not sure. And I've heard stories that Johnny was not really happy with that. And what if you were like, what if this was your first appearance on The Tonight Show, which was the talk show of the day? What if this was your big shot to be on The Tonight Show, millions of people watching you? Johnny dominated late night. There were no three, you know, two Jimmys and a Steven, and they were all equally watched. That's a phenomenon now. Late night television is a shadow of what it used to be. Johnny was so dominant, everybody watched The Tonight Show. So if you're an entertainer and you got booked on The Tonight Show, this was huge exposure for you, and this could change your career. And if it did for many people. Drew Carey and is one who basically says, if it wasn't for Johnny Carson, I wouldn't be where I am right now. One appearance on The Tonight Show during a certain period of time, certainly in the 60s and 70s and even in the 80s, literally could change your life. Literally can change your career overnight. So what if this was your shot? You're sitting there talking to Johnny, and then Bob Hope just saunters on, and you have to move down the couch, and your segment's probably over because Bob has to promote his special.
Isn't that wild? That's wild.
I mean, but that's the kind of clout this guy had. And I remember, as a young kid, as I said, saying how you cannot always predict a public reaction. I remember being a little kid and watching this Bob Hope phenomenon. And he would play golf with presidents, and he went to Vietnam to entertain the troops, and he went to Iraq, I believe. I mean, he was like the ambassador of entertainment. He was just that big. And I remember when he was at this period in the 70s and certainly in the 80s still, where he had this kind of aura and this, this power, if you will. And I remember saying to somebody, man, I don't want to be around when Bob Hope dies, because, my gosh, they're going to shut down the country. I mean, I'd seen a couple of presidential, you know, funerals or VIP funerals where, you know, the television was, and this is even before the 24-hour CNNs and 24-hour cable networks where they would, network television would break into their programming to show the funeral of a president. And I'm like, my gosh, I think Bob Hope's going to have, there's going to be more of a big deal when Bob Hope dies than a president. I mean, this guy seems like he's more popular than the president, and he's got more power than the president. What the heck? He stops the Tonight Show. And so I was like, wow, I don't want to be around when Bob Hope dies. My gosh, they're going to close the schools. They're going to give you a day off of work. I mean, my gosh, it's going to just be the biggest news there is, because this guy is just so, I don't even know, ubiquitous. He's everywhere. He's Bob Hope. But here's the thing that I've come to learn with time and watching pop culture, especially in the entertainment stuff. If you're an entertainer, you really don't, this is the great irony. You know, we all want to live as long as we can. We want to live a long, healthy life, right? I mean, that's our goal. We're here a short time. May seem long, but it really isn't. And so we all want to live a long life. But if you're an entertainer, and don't forget, to be a successful entertainer, I don't care how grounded you may seem to the public, you have got it's not even a huge ego. It's as big as those balloons at the Macy's Day Parade, you know, on Thanksgiving. That's how big of an ego you've got to have to be a successful entertainer. And it's not a shot. It's not a negative thing, but it takes a lot of confidence and a big ego to think that you are so talented or so special that people will want to watch you. It takes a certain kind of confidence and a certain amount of ambition and a certain size of an ego to believe that, to make that reality. As I said, it's not a shot at anyone. Those are the tools you need. Doctors need information about health, and lawyers need to put information about the law, and that's what entertainers need to be successful. And so I was like, my gosh, they're just going to this, you know, Bob Hope's death is going to stop our country. But here's the thing. If you're an entertainer, we all, as humans, we want to live a long life. But if you're an entertainer and you want to feed that ego and you want to be remembered, if you want to be remembered by people, and if you want to have the society shut down, or you want wall-to-wall coverage of your passing, and you want this, your death, to be discussed by people, and 10 years after you're gone, you still want people to remember you and wish you were still around. If you want that kind of post-mortem fame, you had fame while you were alive. But here's the thing. You're going to be dead longer than you were alive, right? I mean, that's just reality. You may have lived to be 100, and you're still going to wind up being dead longer than you were alive. But if you want that kind of legacy, like a Shakespeare or a Mozart or a Benjamin Franklin or a George Washington, people who are still remembered hundreds of years after they've passed away, then what I have found, at least if you're an entertainer or a politician or anyone in the public eye, but mostly an entertainer, if you want that kind of long legacy to be remembered, and you want to be feted and remembered, especially at the time of your death, like, my gosh, this is a time of sorrow and remembrance, and everybody is, oh, that person was so great, and every station stops their programming to talk about you, and people come out of the woodwork to tell stories about you, and there's pictures in the paper and if you want that kind of, to cause that kind of a stir when you pass, then you better not outlive your peers. And you say, well, what does that mean, Jim? Well, I'll tell you. I should tell you, I'm doing a podcast here, and I try to do it for at least an hour. So I'll tell you. If you outlive your peers, meaning if you outlive the people that were around when whatever you did to become famous, whatever you did to stand out, whatever you did to become a celebrity in any way, whether you're a politician, entertainer, whatever it was, when you were in your prime, when you were hitting on all cylinders, when you were, for instance, just mentioning, like right now, this is Taylor Swift's sweet spot, right? She's 33 years old and she has hit the pinnacle of fame. She can only go down now. So if you're Taylor Swift, for instance, let's just use her because right now she's the biggest star in the world, no question. You really don't want to live to be 85 or 90 years old. I mean, you do as a person, but as a celebrity, as an entity, as a public entity, if you want to be mourned and felt the loss of you and remembered, if you live too long a life, if you outlive your peers, then the people that remember you most, the people that were so excited by you, the people that gave you that fame, that gave you that fortune, that gave you that notoriety, that appreciated whatever it was you did, they're gone. Or they're certainly not a part of, they're not driving the culture anymore. And most likely you're not either. And the people that are in the power seats in terms of the media to dispense this news, well, they're most likely in their 20s and 30s and 40s. They don't remember you either. They may have heard of you, but they weren't around when you were at your pinnacle. So they'll see a name that they will that has some recognition to it. But if you're a celebrity and you die within the time that your peer group is still in power, is still driving the culture, then you will get that stop the presses kind of treatment when you pass. John Lennon, for instance, right? 40 years old, tragically killed. The people who were Beatles fans were younger than 40. They still had the energy. They were around when John was doing what he did. The people that were in the media to make the decisions, to send the camera crews, to send the photographers, to send the reporters, they were John Lennon fans. They were Beatle fans. So they were like, this is huge. Stop the presses. But for instance, perfect example, when George Harrison died, he was 57 years old. He died in, 2001, I believe? It made a big stir, but it wasn't, and it was only 57, but it wasn't as if he was still in his prime. And by that time, many of the Beatles fanatics were out of the media. The younger people were driving the culture. Yes, we heard of George Harrison. Yes, he was a Beatle. But the people that experienced it were not in positions now to dominate that. Like when Elvis died at age 42, that stopped the presses. That dominated coverage. Because he was only 42 years old, the people that loved Elvis remembered him in his prime. Now, my point is Bob Hope lived to be 100 years old. When Bob Hope was in his prime or even past his prime, but still very popular in his 70s and 80s, he still lived another 20 years. So by the time he passed away, I expected, my gosh, as I said, they're going to, you know, if this guy is so popular, I don't want to be around. But you know what? When Bob Hope died, it certainly made news. Because he had some, you know, he had fame and he had this long career. But the people who remembered him publicly as well as professionally, most of them were gone. they passed away before he did. Or, as I said, the people in charge of the media machine, they didn't experience Bob Hope from the 30s and 40s and 50s. They heard of him. They gave him his due. Bob Hope passed away, legendary entertainer at age 100. He starred in this many films. They had a few people on, and then they moved on. But if Bob Hope had died in the 1970s, or even in the 80s, oh my gosh, the president of the United States would have said something. They would have lowered the flags. But Bob Hope sort of went away with a whimper. He lived an extraordinary life filled with fame and fortune and influence. As I said, he golfed with presidents. He traveled the world. He saw world leaders. He was one of the most popular and richest entertainers. You couldn't have asked for anything more. But when he passed away, he lived too long. He outlived his fame to some extent. Because the people that would have been able to tell those stories and have been excited and felt his loss were no longer around. Those around were second or third parties to that fame. You saw the list of accomplishments. You said, that's nice, but you didn't experience them. Why do we still talk about, not so much anymore, but at the time when Jimi Hendrix or Jim Morrison and Janis Joplin all died, it was a huge, at that time, it was a huge deal. They were 27 years old. They were at the primes of their careers, or they hadn't even reached their potential yet. That was the great, tragedy of their deaths. They were popular, but there was so much more to do. But it was earth-shattering within the rock world, because my gosh, these were people that were vibrant and active at the time. And so the people that mourn their loss, they experienced it firsthand. If you're an entertainer and you live past the time where those who knew you and experienced your talent or whatever you did, you don't get that same kind of treatment. So the question is, if you're an entertainer, do you want to live a long life or do you want to go out a legend? Because if you want to go out a legend, you're going to have to sacrifice a long life, I think. and for instance, here, one of the greatest actors, right, is Dustin Hoffman or Gene Hackman in the last 30 or 40 years, right? Do you ever hear about them anymore? I think Gene Hackman's in his 90s. Dustin Hoffman's 85 or so. I mean, the guy's won a couple of Academy Awards. At the time, one of the greatest actors of his generation, no question. But more and more of the people that remembered him seeing The Graduate, they're not in power anymore. So yes, I'm using him as an example because he's one of the greatest actors of the last 50 or 60 years. But when he passes away, there's going to be people that are working at the TV stations or in their 20s and 30s and will go, "Oh, Dustin Hoffman died." Yes, okay, and they're going to do the story, and they will have some people, but it's not the same as if he would have died 20 years ago. My gosh, Dustin Hoffman. I remember waiting out in the line to see the Rain Man. The people in charge of the TV stations and the news operations to get that word out, they won't have that perfect personal experience. And I say that, and I bring all this up, because there was a death in the last couple of weeks that you would have thought, as I said, you can't predict this stuff. I would have thought it would have made a bigger splash. It would have been debated more. It would have been talked about more. But once again, part of it is this person's notorious infamy. But part of it, too, is that people who are in charge of the media right now didn't experience him firsthand. They knew they had an obligation to report on his death and talk about his life and the circumstances surrounding it, how he became infamous, not just famous, but infamous. But they didn't have that same connection. So the news, when it came, made a huge splash, made a big boom when it happened, but it quickly disappeared. It shows in today's world, too, how we just move on from news, unless there's something really catastrophic. But even then, as I said, tell me what's going on Maui right now. Do you hear about Lahaina anymore? I don't know what's going on there. Have they rebuilt it? Are they rebuilding it? I don't know. When that hurricane or that fire took place there with the hurricane and everything and wiped out Lahaina on Maui, we certainly heard about it for a good week. And now, I don't know what's going on there. We are in a very disposable, read it and toss it kind of culture. The person I'm talking about whose death is O.J. Simpson. The Juice. A fascinating figure. And you could say that and positively and negatively. A great high school and college and then professional football player, Hall of Famer, broke the single season rushing record back in the 70s with the Buffalo Bills, made a almost effortless transition from playing football after he got just too old to play, some bad, injuries and bad knees and age, as happens to every football player and every athlete, and they find themselves in their 30s and 40s having to reinvent themselves. And O.J. had very little trouble reinventing himself. He was a forerunner of athletes doing commercials. He was a good-looking guy, popular guy, O.J. Everybody knew O.J. He just said O.J. You knew who it was. He did these commercials for Hertz Rent-A-Car, put Hertz Rent-A-Car on the map. People still remember O.J. Simpson running through he was a running back, right? The commercial showed O.J. running through the airport, leaping over people to get and got his rent-a-car. If you were around during those days, you remember the O.J. Simpson Hertz commercial, no question about it. And O.J.'s big smile, and you remember him running through the airport and leaping over people. I can close my eyes and picture it now. I haven't seen that commercial in 40 or 50 years, and I can still remember it. He made the transition from commercials into television and then movies and broadcasting. Everybody loved O.J. Football hero turned TV pitchman, turned actor, turned pop culture icon, O.J. Simpson. When you attain first name status, it's a rarefied level where you live. If someone can say just your first name, and everybody knows who they're talking about, that's a very unique type of stardom. That is the pinnacle of stardom. If you say the name Cher, if you say the name Bruce, if you say the name Elton, if you say the name, Dustin, right? Talking about movies. If you say Martin, Martin Scorsese. If you've attained that kind of first name status, then that's the ultimate. And O.J. had that. And then in 1994, it all came crashing down. And this is what I'm saying about I was surprised at the reaction and the lack of attention, at least longer-term attention that O.J. Simpson's passing got. He died of prostate cancer at age 76. Not too young, not too old, especially by today's standards. But no question, he had a very tarnished and complex legacy. He had this first part of his life, first 40-some years of his life, was a dream. And the last 30 was mired in controversy and a swirl of emotions. It's hard to describe how you should or feel about O.J. Simpson. Now, for those of you, and this is my point, there's many people. In 1994, a horrendous murder took place in California. O.J. Simpson's ex-wife and a friend of hers, Nicole Brown Simpson, and Ron Goldman, a friend of hers. Horrendous murder. Two people. Ron Goldman was stabbed more than 30 times. Okay? Not once. Not twice. Not 10 times. He was stabbed and killed 30. He was stabbed 30 times. Nicole Brown Simpson, OJ's ex-wife, was beaten and again cut to the point that her head was literally, I mean, it was for all intents and purposes, cut off her body. She wasn't completely decapitated, but it might as well have been. That's a brutal, brutal, violent murder. And what O.J. Simpson went through with the guilt and the trial and the evidence, he was there that night. It seemed to be a no-brainer as to who would have had a motive and who would and who the evidence pointed to. And for a good year, more than a year, the murders took place in June of 94. The trial, I believe, took place in sometime in September or October, the verdict of 1995. So more than a year, almost a year and a half, O.J. Simpson was in the news every day. His notoriety, his fall from grace, his apparent and seemingly obvious guilt, and then his very theatrical and dramatic and shocking trial, which was televised and literally became one of the most watched and talked about television shows, because that's what it really was, in the history of this country. It was a pop culture phenomenon. And then, of course, the verdict shocked everyone. And while it shocked everyone, it really divided this country by race. O.J. Simpson was an icon and well-liked by all people, regardless of races. He transcended race. But when it came to this murder and his possible guilt in these two horrendous, blood-filled murders, it came down to racial lines because the evidence was so overwhelming. And yet O.J. was such an iconic and positive figure in the black community that it was hard for African Americans to go against O.J. They didn't want to see their idol fall from grace like this. They wanted so hard for O.J. to be innocent, or at least in legal terms, not guilty. And white people looked at this and said, well, we like O.J. too, but look at these murders. And the fact that there was two white people that were killed just added to the racial divide. I bring this up because we look at our world today, and I'm shocked that the O.J. Simpson death did not make more headlines and inspire more discussion for a longer time, because 30 years later, after those murders and after that trial and that divisive verdict of O.J. being found not guilty by a jury that was predominantly African-American, it really split this country up racially. When the verdict was announced, and you can go online and see this, this is no exaggeration, when the O.J. Simpson verdict was announced on live television, and believe me, we all watched it. Those of us who were around, we all watched it. I remember I was working at Zenith Electronics in the public relations department, and the verdict was going to be read around noon our time here, about 10 a.m., and we ordered pizza to watch the O.J. verdict in the office. We were in my boss's office, and we ordered pizza, and we were there watching the verdict live. Everybody remembers where they were when they heard the O.J. Simpson verdict. And when it was announced that he was found not guilty, they had cameras outside the courtroom, outside the courthouse. And African-American supporters of O.J. cheered like he's just scored a touchdown. And white people that were out there were kind of stunned. And it was a turning point, because you could visually see the difference and the divide. And it was right down racial lines. And we look at today's divided country, and we are blaming politicians and political parties. And they certainly are adding to the divisiveness, no question. But I also believe that our divisions did not just happen 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Or 20 years ago. Our divisions have been going on. First of all, if you really want to go back, if you really want to be honest, the divisions of race in this country have been there before we became a country. Our Constitution, which we still hold up as this sacred document, at the center of it, the Constitution ultimately is a document that is written through compromise. Because our country wasn't even a country yet, and there was a good chance it wouldn't be a country, an official, fortified, certified country, because of the great racial divide of slavery. That's why in the Constitution, this document that we hold up in such esteem is also very flawed and very, in our terms, racist. It's, if you look at the Constitution, it's taking black slaves and assigning them ratios of how much of a person they are, as opposed to property. That's abhorrent in our viewpoint today. But as I say so many times, you cannot take people or things out of their time. To see that document, you say, this is a race. People could say that's a racist document. And it's hard to disagree with that viewed through our 21st century eyes. But if you view that document through the eyes in the 1700s, it was necessary because the divide was so sharp, against the North and the South in terms of slavery and not slavery, that if there was not some kind of compromise, then there wouldn't have been a United States of America, because the states would not have been united, at least on paper. I don't know if these United States have ever been united. It sounds good. But there wouldn't even have been a document that at least gave the impression of a United States. But when this country was founded, it was founded with half of it having slavery and half of it not. There was a clear line, the Mason-Dixon line. That's what you hear about. The Mason-Dixon line was the difference line between the North and the South, where slavery was abolished and slavery was permitted. So at our core, we have had a racial problem. And we've had a racial problem from that day on. But I do believe that the O.J. Simpson verdict had a huge influence as to where we are today, because it on television for the whole world to see and for this whole country to see, it presented how real and how deep our divide was. But to my earlier point, that trial and those murders were 30 years ago. So there are people that we have to say, because when do you really become aware of things? Maybe when you're 5, maybe 6. You might have some memories. Even when you're 10, you remember things, but it doesn't have that same impact, right? You're more worried about your spelling test and your baseball game and you're selling your Girl Scout cookies. You know, you're not looking at the world or the bigger world around you. You're worried about that little world around you, not the bigger world around all of us. And so, yes, I'm sure if you're 40 years old, you remember the OJ trial. You remember hearing about it. And you may even remember the reaction to it, but it didn't really hit you as hard as it hit older people. So let's use 40 as a dividing line. But let's use 35, because if you're 35 or younger, the O.J. Simpson trial, the O.J. Simpson murders are something you read about or something you've heard about. You didn't experience the moment of the verdict. You didn't experience the moment of the crimes and the white Bronco chase, which was televised live in June of 94. I will never forget that, because this is my point. You knew where you were. The O.J. Simpson saga was the first real big pop culture event that was televised. Almost like a reality show. We talk about, Survivor and Real World. No. The first reality show was the O.J. Simpson saga, the murders and the trial. That was the first reality show. And I got news for you. That was the real reality. The reality shows you watch today are scripted. They're not reality. That was reality. That's when reality television started. In 1994, not with Survivor in 2000, not with The Real World. That was when reality television started. It was broadcast 24 hours a day on some stations on C-SPAN, and certainly it gave validity to CNN. It gave validity to the 24-hour news, cable news stations. It gave them viewership. It gave them the freedom to cover that story every which way they could, that could not happen on the networks. And it gave birth to the other types of 24-hour stations. When other media moguls looked around and said, whoa, look at what this 24-hour news service can do when there's a story that merits it. And so it gave birth to the popularity then of your Foxes and your MSNBCs and your CNBCs. The O.J. Simpson trial and saga, these murders, have had a huge influence on our culture today. The 24-hour news cycle, the tabloid journalism of the Inquirer and things like that. Don't forget, there was no internet. It was just beginning at that time. It hadn't taken hold yet. It was there, but it wasn't like it is today. There was no social media. There was an internet. You can find the news online, but it wasn't social media. The people really weren't able to express their immediate reactions from their cell phones because there were no smartphones in 1994 and 95. Those didn't come until 2007. I know that sounds crazy. Yes, there was an internet, but it wasn't as dominant. It wasn't the social media cauldron of opinion and reaction that it is now because there were no social media sites like that. But the O.J. Simpson trial, as I said, and the murders and the trial and the whole saga gave birth to reality TV, validated and elevated the 24-hour news cycles, created talking heads, spawned careers for people, reporters who and experts wound up hosting their own shows because they were on television every day, giving their opinion about how the trial went. How did it go today? How did it go today? Media careers were made. Industries were made. And as I said before, this country was divided. You have to also remember in the context of this, and this is, I didn't hear this mentioned quite any as much. I didn't hear a lot of the influence that the O.J. Simpson saga had. And I'm surprised that at his death, this wasn't discussed more. But then it made sense because the people, even though there were several people that, you know, a lot of the main players have died. And as I said, right now, running the major cable networks and TV networks are people in their, running it are in their 30s and 40s. They don't have that same personal, visceral effect and experience of watching the O.J. Simpson trial. So, yes, they heard about it. They know about it. They can understand a little, but they're still once removed from it. They could watch the clips on YouTube or anywhere, but they didn't watch it when it happened. And they didn't have the exposure of O.J. Simpson's first 40 years, where he was this beloved sports hero and popular movie star and personality. That's what gave the O.J. Simpson story such irony, is that he went from being this beloved public figure by all races, and he turned into this divisive character who was hated by some races and loved by another. It was just an ironic social happening. But you also have to, and so there's the context of that, and then you have to remember, which I didn't hear discussed, which I think is a part of the reason that the O.J. trial became so divisive 3 years later. People forget, in 1991, there was another racial incident that really started the divide. But not starting it, but it helped expose it more and refuel it more. As I said, we've had a racial divide in this country from our founding. We had the Jim Crow laws, in the 30s and 40s in the South. And then we had the Civil Rights Movement, where there were people killed and beaten in protests. And then, in 1991, there was a police beating of a African-American man named Rodney King. He was chased in a high-speed chase, and police finally got him, and they took him out of the car, and the L.A. four or five L.A. police brutally beat him. Didn't kill him, but brutally beat him. And as in pure chance, there was somebody with a video camera, no phones at this time, he had a video camera who lived across the street and saw the beating from his balcony and recorded it because the beating was so brutal with billy clubs and kicking and punching. And he recorded it and he gave it to a TV station in LA. And there were race riots. And there were, once again, our racial divide was broadcast. And it was different than it was broadcast in the 60s during the civil rights movement. The media had become much more powerful and much more liberal-minded. And so this was not just swept under the rug like so much of the coverage was in the 60s. This was more about transparency. And then, of course, when I believe three of the four policemen were found not guilty by a white-dominated jury in Los Angeles, well, then there were race riots. Then there were riots in black communities in 1992. So we had some of this racial problems boiling in this country already in the early 90s. And right after the Rodney King situation that was televised, then comes these murders, of which everybody, I believe, even the jury believes that O.J. Simpson was guilty. There was never any other leads done. There was no other reason for someone else to have done this. The trial became more theater than legal. The judge at the time, Judge Ito, became enamored with the fame he was getting being on television every day. O.J. Simpson had a dream team, if you will, of high-profile, high-paid, smart, and media-savvy lawyers, including F. Lee Bailey, who was a very famous lawyer who got another presumably guilty man off of a murder in the 60s, the Shepard case. That's how F. Lee Bailey made his fame. He was brought on to the O.J. Simpson trial. He brought on a very flamboyant African-American lawyer named Johnny Cochran. Oddly enough, the father of the Kardashian girls, Robert Kardashian, who was also a lawyer and a friend of O.J.'s, sitting next to O.J. every day in that trial. Ironically, in 1994, his daughters were little kids. They were not the pop culture icons. We knew who Robert Kardashian was. He was the friend of O.J., and we saw him at the trial. In fact, he goes down in history because when the not guilty verdict was announced, even Robert Kardashian, a friend of O.J.'s, who sat next to him at the trial as a friend and a supporter, when the not guilty verdict was announced, watch that video. Go on YouTube if you don't remember it. And if you do remember it, you'll be shocked to see it if you didn't notice it, or just to see it again. But even Robert Kardashian, short guy with black hair combed back and glasses, that's how you'll see him, when the O.J. Simpson verdict was announced, even he turns and looks at O.J., and there's a look of shock and confusion and almost sadness, like, oh my God, how did you get away with this? Everybody at the defense table Everyone who knew O.J., everybody knew that O.J. did it. But this trial took on great racial implications. In the wake of the Rodney King trial just 2 years before, where the white policemen who clearly were beating Rodney King and were still found innocent, the O.J. Simpson trial gave African Americans, in their minds, a chance for some payback. And you can't blame the sentiment. If you saw the Rodney King beating, there is no excuse for that. Yes, there was a high-speed chase and there was adrenaline going on. There's no question that these cops were humans and they were pent up with this aggression. They were following this guy. He was chased. They were chasing him. But the way they treated him and the way they beat him is still was above and beyond. There was no justification for that. And yet, once again, the African-American community saw white perpetrators get away with a crime against a black man. And this is nothing new. As I said before, you cannot blame the African community for this. We've seen, especially during the civil rights times, the famous Emmett Till case of a 14-year-old African-American boy who was from Chicago, went to visit his some relatives in Mississippi, and supposedly was 14. He went to some kind of a drugstore, a small little convenience store or something, and supposedly made some remarks or was flirting with a white woman in the owner's wife or something, may have said something, may have whistled, whatever it was. In the Deep South, black men were not supposed to fraternize with white women. Those were they were almost written laws, but they were certainly the unwritten laws, especially with the existence of the Ku Klux Klan and other racially hating groups at that time. And the way the story goes, Emmett Till was hunted down in his home by a group of vigilantes, including the husband of the woman who he supposedly made comments to. And they beat him and they threw him in the river, I believe. His body was found a couple of days later, so severely beaten, beyond almost recognition. But his mother did a brave thing here in Chicago, brought him back, had his funeral, and had an open casket because she wanted people to see what had been done to her son. And once again, in the Deep South, with a white jury, the people who beat Emmett Till were found not guilty. And a lot of times, a lot of people point to Rosa Parks not wanting to sit at the back of the bus as the beginning of the civil rights movement, but there's no question that the Emmett Till case, the beating that he took, and the exoneration of his murderers was a key event to spark the beginning of the civil rights movement here in the United States. So there's no question. And there, you know, there's a movie called Mississippi Burning that came out in 1988 with Alec Baldwin, which tells the story of three social activists that were killed because they were working in the South, in Mississippi, to help black voters, to register voters. There was two white men and a black man, I believe, there. They were students. They were lynched and killed. by the Ku Klux Klan for helping blacks. And they were found not guilty. So there's no question that justice has not been done in this country when it comes to juries and race. So you can understand that in 1995, with a predominantly African-American jury and a black man on trial for killing two white people, the exact opposite of what we've seen in justice, where white people have killed a black person and have been found not guilty, it's not hard to understand that there was a sense that now it's our time for some payback. And even though there's no question that the evidence pointed to O.J. Simpson's undisputable guilt, the injustices that the African-American community had witnessed throughout the years, especially over the last 30 or 40 years when that happened, gave them in their minds some justification regardless of O.J. Simpson's obvious guilt in these two horrendous murders, to find him not guilty. And O.J. Simpson's lawyers were very smart by distracting the jury and the facts, by making this a racial trial, by bringing in a police detective who was shown to be racist, and then they could tie the fact that, well, this evidence may have been corrupted by this guy who hates African Americans. They had to do what they could. The defense had two goals, I believe, of O.J. Simpson and why they succeeded. They couldn't focus on the evidence because the evidence was so overwhelming. There's no other reason, there's no other person who could have done this, aside from having a video. I mean, O.J.'s blood was at the murder scene. There was blood in his Bronco, in his car. It goes without saying. But what the defense lawyers had to do was distract the jury away from the facts and really create a scenario where the jury could find O.J. not guilty and point to some evidence other than the crime scene to justify it. There's no question that the defense knew that this predominantly black jury would want to find O.J. innocent. For, as I said, from a pure historical, even though these were horrendous crimes, the African community felt that they had not been given justice in so many other high-profile cases when white people had killed black people. And so they were preying on that. But they had to also give the jury some reason to justify their not guilty, because it would look, if they didn't, if it was just based on the facts and the evidence of the case, it would look like a racially motivated crime or motivated verdict. So they had to create enough reasonable doubt, or at least enough of an explanation or a theory that the jury could cling to say, well, the prosecution, I mean, maybe he did it, but they didn't prove the case. And so that's where they brought in Mark Furman, who was a policeman, who was at the scene, who they had on tape making racial comments. So they claimed that he was a racist and he may have tampered with the evidence. They had to try whatever they could do to put some of this overwhelming evidence into question. They tried to show that OJ had more than, which is true, had more than 60 calls of domestic abuse in his marriage with Nicole. But that didn't prove he killed her. That was the way the jury went. So the defense's job, then of course there was the infamous, you know, bloody gloves where OJ said that they didn't fit. He showed it even though he's putting these gloves on top of rubber gloves, and they were also leather gloves that were shrunk because they were so, this is true, the gloves were so saturated in blood that they shrunk because they were so wet in blood. That's how grisly this murder scene was. As I said, 30 times Ron Goldman was stabbed and Nicole Simpson's head was practically cut off. The murder scene was horrendous. And yet, despite all that evidence, OJ was found not guilty. Not innocent, just not guilty. But that verdict really exposed on national television the racial divide that still existed in this country. There was a feeling, and once again, unless you were living in this time, you can't really express that unless you experienced it. And that's like I said before, you cannot underestimate the power of experience. And the experience of what was happening at the time, the country felt in 1994 that it had moved a good deal racially, even though it really hadn't, but that people felt, at least white people felt, like things had been done to rectify during the 60s and the 70s and the riots. There were more African Americans in power, in political power. There was affirmative action. People didn't feel, at least the white community didn't feel, that things were as oppressive as they really were. There was a sense that, yes, there was always some racial divide, but it had gotten better. That was the perception. But the OJ trial, which was broadcast live every day for 10 months, and the murder started in 94, this whole saga was going on for a year and a half. It was on television every day. On CNN and the other news, 24 News, there was no other stories happening. Every moment was dissecting every little piece of the OJ story. People became celebrities because of it. Johnny Cochran, like I said, Robert Kardashian, Kate O'Kalin, Faye Resnick. She was a friend of Nicole Simpson. She wound up being in Playboy magazine. I mean, it was the side characters. As I said, Kate O'Kalin, this goofy kind of, you know, friend of OJ's who just was living in his garage or something. You know, all these people became semi-celebrities. It really was a theatric. It was theater of the absurd for a year and a half. And it really exposed how divided we were. And that divide has only continued. That divide has only continued because think about it. 10 years after that, once again, perhaps there was a looking at, well, how do we fix this divide? This O.J. Simpson trial has shown what a great racial divide there is. We've got to do something about it. Well, you know, 10 years or so after that, Barack Obama is elected president. What, 2008? Wow. You know, what, 13 years later? What am I known? I'm not even talking about. So let's see, 90, it's five, yeah. 13 years later. We've got a president. We've got an African-American president. But that also added to the divide. And it gave rise to Donald Trump and then the more of the divide. But to say that we've only been divided for the last 10 or 15 years is crazy. The O.J. Simpson saga, the O.J. Simpson trial, didn't start our racial divide, but it exposed it widely for the first time because of the saturated exposure it got on the 24-hour news channels. And so when OJ died, I was expecting a lot of this to get debated and talked about and rehashed. But once again, there was some discussion, but not as much as I thought there would be. And that I think there should have been, because I think we should have looked at this closer to say, where are we today as a result of that? And let's try to see the mistakes we made there so that we don't make them again. But you know what? That happened long enough ago that people that are in charge right now, who are driving our culture, who are in charge of the media, they didn't experience it firsthand. So OJ and his complex, horrendous legacy did not get the kind of reaction that you would have expected. When it was announced, it made big news. OJ Simpson died, because it was a surprise. I mean, there was rumors that he was sick, but nobody knew that he was this seriously sick. And suddenly he was dead. But the scrutiny of the trial, the absurdity of the trial, the obviousness of his guilt, the Bronco chase, the side celebrities that were created, all of the drama and reality television that was born out of that was really not discussed and shown as I thought it would have been. So O.J. Simpson passes, and I guess part of it, maybe, if you're looking for an explanation for it, one way that I look at it is perhaps people say, well, we don't want to highlight this because we don't want to give O.J. any more recognition one way or the other, positive or negative. It's best that he just goes away. Everybody knows he's guilty. And once again, I also mentioned that a few years later, he was found responsible for the murders in a civil trial, which basically hinged upon a piece of evidence that the prosecution at his murder trial did not have. If you recall, he was wearing a specific pair of shoes, designer shoes, that left a very specific imprint. And those same shoes that he owned and had a photo of him wearing left that imprint in blood at the murder scene. And that's what was a key piece of evidence that jury in the civil case found him not guilty. You know, double jeopardy, he could not be tried for murder again, but he was found civilly responsible for the murders, and he owed the family, the Goldman family, who brought the case, $33 million, of which they have not received anywhere near that kind of money. But at least there was some sort of legal responsibility by OJ. And then, of course, in a crazy twist that the story, you couldn't have written this, he winds up going to jail anyway for 6 or 7 years on some crazy plot that he did to get back his stolen Heisman Trophy, and he was involved in a robbery. And so he went to jail for 7 years, even though it was not for the murder, which everybody expects and suspects and believes that he really did do. So he, in a weird twist of fate, he went to jail after he got exonerated for this horrendous murder. He winds up going to jail on some robbery thing. It was the theater of the absurd. OJ's last, 35 years were crazy. They were just crazy. And, but I think you have to look back at the history of this and say, we look at ourselves today, and I totally believe that divide that we have today and our culture and our behavior and our views and that divide wasn't created 30 some years ago, but certainly was exposed and exacerbated and has festered since then. And we are living in a result of the O.J. Simpson murders and trial and verdict. So O.J. Simpson passes away at age 76. The first half of his life was filled with glorious, screaming headlines. And then the last half of his life, he died with barely a whimper. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNradio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 414. I'm Jim Toronto. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, from the end of my mind to your ears.